So good evening. Is there anyone here for the first time tonight? Great. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Welcome. And I think I would like to start by just reading something together because I'm going to talk about it. And maybe some of us know it very, very well, we think, and maybe others have never heard it ever. So let's all get our little chant books. I don't seem to have one. I should know it by heart. I think I do know it by heart, but anyhow. Yeah, if you can find your way to the Heart Sutra, which is called the Heart of Great Perfect Wisdom Sutra on page 3, let's just read together the first, we'll read, just read until I stop, okay? So, and you don't have to, this is optional. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Okay, so we could go on and on, but we won't, because I think that's only as far as, if that far, that we might get. So is there anybody who, this is the first time that you've ever heard the Heart Sutra? Okay, so even a new person, you've heard it before. Yeah, this chant is chanted in Buddhist temples and centers and groups all over the world and all different schools of Buddhism. It's chanted at this temple six times a week. We chant it, the only day we don't chant it is Sunday evening when we chant the Metta Sutta, but it's chanted every morning either in English or in Japanese. The language of our founding teachers, and we also chant it in English on Saturday morning. So it's a pretty important chant, and I was talking to some people about this a couple of months ago, and kind of what I heard was, yeah, it's great, I just have no idea what it means. And I thought, well, yeah, right. Maybe, you know, yeah, sure, skandhas and form and emptiness and yeah, you know. But I realized, well, if I was actually going to try to talk about it, would I actually know what to say? And I realized, not really. And so when Kokyo invited me to give this talk, I thought, well, there's a challenge. I'm going to, this is going to be my topic. And so I'm going to need to study a little more than I do sometimes for some of my talks, because I want to know, not like in some logical, linear, you know, academic way, but what is this? What is this teaching? So I worked a lot with Red Pine's book about the Heart Sutra and Mu Song's book about the Heart Sutra, and looking into my own experience. And I was kind of going along, and it was pretty interesting. I went to Texas a couple of weeks ago to visit my family. My brother and his family had to move to Houston, 12 minutes away from Houston Zen Center and Galen, so that's kind of cool. But anyhow, I was sitting there, and, you know, there was some time when we weren't talking, and so I'd be sitting in the living room studying my Heart Sutra material, taking notes. And they're dealing with some hard things in their family. But two of my nieces have developed a disease that is one of those kind of mysterious autoimmune things that they can't really tell you exactly where it comes from or how to cure it. And so one of the things that I did while I was there was I had a lot of time talking with both my brother and my sister-in-law about their own feelings and what they're doing. And I was particularly struck one day when I was just alone with my sister-in-law, who's a very, usually quite stoic person, very much a just keep on trucking, you know, kind of person. And she really started to open up about her suffering, about her child, and her anguish about what to do about this situation. And it struck me as I was sitting there studying this material, and I thought, what does this have to do with being with a mother who is suffering because her child is, she doesn't know how to help her child, and she feels helpless and powerless, and she's really scared about it. If this can't have something to say about that, then what is this effort that I'm making here to study the Heart Sutra? So I just wanted to kind of tell you that in advance, because I'm actually going to start by maybe what might sound like a little bit more kind of deconstruction approach, where I want to talk about these words. I want to talk about what I learned about some of these words. But then I want to relate it to the big koan that I had, was how does this connect to an actual suffering being who is, whom I love and who is in the room with me? So that was my challenge for this talk. So we'll see how it goes. So first of all, the being who is speaking the Heart Sutra is who? Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. This is what it tells us right in the beginning. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, while practicing the deep practice of Prajnaparamita, blah, 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 blah. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, you know, the Bodhisattva is the, it, on one level, it's sort of an archetypal, mythical, sort of Buddhist figure of a being who isn't here for his or her own salvation, but their sole purpose is to help others awaken. And there's these, you know, like on the altar, we have Manjushri, and we have these statues of these archetypal bodhisattvas, but it's also all of us. And any time we're clear about the vow to awaken with all beings, we're doing bodhisattva practice. So in this case, it's this kind of more mythical Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, who happens to be the Bodhisattva of compassion. Avalokiteshvara means listening to the cries of the world. So this teaching, which sounds, when you get into it, like it might be kind of abstract and it's about wisdom, the person who, or the being who's delivering his teaching, is the highest manifestation of compassion that we have in our religion. And Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva who has been both female and male. In India, the Avalokiteshvara figure is a male, and in China, Kuan Yin is female, Kanzeon, Kanon in Japan is female. The Tibetan, the Vajrayana tradition, I don't know the name, I know Tara, but there's also another one who's kind of Avalokiteshvara. So anyhow, here's this figure that represents great compassion, who is both female and male. So it's all of us. This is for all of us. This is a wise one that is all of us. So I'll say she, because I'm female, so I'll refer to Avalokiteshvara as she, but could also be he. Maybe I'll change in the middle, who knows? So what's Avalokiteshvara doing before she is going to expound this teaching? Well, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing, she's deeply practicing. She's not studying. She's not reading. She's not trying to figure things out. She's deeply practicing. And, you know, I think as we often talk about here, you know, practice, it can be something that we do quietly and silently alone, the way that we all just sat together practicing Zazen in community. But practicing is also engaging in the world, in our lives, with the beings of our lives, and trying to be as awake and present as we can. That's practicing. So she was practicing. And what was she practicing? Prajna Paramita. Okay, so what's that? Well, you know, the paramitas, that word is sometimes translated as perfection, but it's also translated as, you know, it's the vehicle that carries us across the river of suffering. It's also, there's another translation of it as, what was the term? Cultivating attributes, you know. So it's kind of a strange word, but the word that I think is more important is prajna. Prajna is literally, they translate it as wisdom. But again, what do we mean by wisdom in Buddhism? What we mean by wisdom is seeing directly into the true nature of things. That's what we call wisdom. The direct apprehension. Direct apprehension of the intimacy of our lives and how we all are connected. You know, the intimacy of sitting in that living room and feeling the suffering of this usually stoic, got-it-all-together woman as she was sharing her anguish about not knowing what to do for her child. The intimacy of that, seeing and feeling that. A quote from Shohaku, it's not mere insight or wisdom, but it's really a practice, living, interacting, and practicing together with all beings. So that's what we mean when we say wisdom. And prajna paramita is the practice of seeing directly into the true nature of things, the practice of experiencing our intimacy. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing the deep practice of prajna paramita, the practice of doing this intimacy with all things, what happened? Okay. Saw. Sometimes it's perceived, clearly saw in our version, or perceived in other versions, that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. So I want, if you can stay with me a little bit more on this word-by-word thing before I kind of try to bring it home the first time in terms of applying it to my real-life situation. I think I found it really helpful to actually demystify these terms and really try to understand what is this talking about. So while deeply practicing prajna paramita, and again, she perceived it, she clearly saw it, it was from her experience that she comes to the place where she's bringing us this teaching. It's not, again, oh, I read it in, you know, in the parchment paper, you know, or whatever, or the preacher told me. It's through my own direct experience, my own practice, I have perceived this to be true. So what is it that she perceived? That all five skandhas are empty. Okay, what's that? All right, so here we go, a little bit of definitions. So skandha, the word skandha, literally in Sanskrit, it means heap, like a heap of something, a heap of oatmeal that you get in your bowl, or, you know, a heap of leaves that we rake out in the garden. It's also, it's translated as aggregate. In our translation, they're the five aggregates. Well, aggregates of what, or heap of what? And this is actually one of the, I'd say it's in the area of one of the most radical aspects of the Buddhist teaching, is this, which is, first, there's five skandhas. Okay, so I'll just name them. So one of them is form. And form is the material world, the material body. So all of my digestive system, my perceptual system, my sense organs, my saliva, my skin, you know, this is form. It's one of the ways we experience our human life is through form. And then there's four that are related to how we perceive the world. So the second skanda is feeling or sensation. And by this, it's not meant emotions, but just literally just the, my sense organ, my hand, is touching this, is making contact with this object, and the feeling I'm having is, in Buddhism, it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Those are the three choices. Not how I feel about it, that comes in a minute, but just this feeling of, and it's actually neutral. I mean, maybe I could say it's a little bit pleasant to me, this wood, but it's actually kind of neutral, right? Now, what might be something that I would feel is pleasant? Oh, the hot water up in Harbin. That's pleasant. Sense organ contact out external world goes, I like it, right? What would be unpleasant? Well,
the cold ocean.
The cold ocean, right, for some of us. But now raise your hand here if you actually like to get in the cold ocean. Yeah, a little a minority, but yeah, no, there's a member of our Sangha here who goes swimming in the ocean. She dives off the rocks and swims out there. Me, unpleasant, absolutely. Cold, salt water, gets kind of seasick, right? So that's the feeling skanda, all right? Perception, the image in the mind, that the feeling or the sensation, my perception of it, the formation, kind of what I do with it, all of the volitional impulses that precede an action, the personality's conditioned, formation of it, and then consciousness, vijnana, those of you who've studied all that stuff, is then the discriminating mind. So what I don't want to do tonight is get into a real lecture about the details about the skandhas, but in this teaching, when Avalokiteshvara is, through her deep practice, perceiving the emptiness of all these things, that's kind of what I want to talk about. One certainly can study the skandhas. There are tons of writings about this whole thing, but the point of the emptiness point is we act as though all of these things are true and fixed. We act as though, when we perceive something and when we form it in our head and when it's like, oh, you scrunched your face up. And I am having an unpleasant, it's conjuring an image in my mind of when my father used to do that. And when my father used to do it, it meant that he was pulling away emotionally. And therefore, when you're doing it, that means you're pulling away emotionally. And so what I'm going to do in response to that is I'm going to try to control you to make you like me. All these things that we do, and that go on in our unconscious body-mind perceptual apparatus that we have as humans, which is a gift. It's a gift in that it's what allows us to make art. It's what allows us to write music. It's a beautiful thing. It's also the source of our suffering because we make up stories. We think, oh, because you did this, that means I have to do that, as if that was the only option that we had of how to be together. And when you get into studying this kind of skanda level of Buddhist psychology, this is Buddhist psychology, then you start kind of questioning it. And see, I think this is what, to sit and deeply perceive prajnaparamita, to sit, say, when you're sitting zazen, and if you have a formation that you notice as you're sitting in silence, wow, I'm having that same thought again. I wonder what that is. And holding it kind of lightly, not getting into it, but just, what is that? That investigation is part of this deeply studying prajnaparamita. And the conclusion that she and that the people who made up these things and invented this together, what they came to realize is that actually these things that we think are fixed, it's just a process. It's an ever-changing process, like Musong uses the example of a hurricane. You look at the weather map on the internet, and you see this thing, right? It's got all these colors, and it's a hurricane. And we think, oh, there it is. We give it a name, Hurricane Mabel, you know? And we talk about Hurricane Mabel. Hurricane Mabel is a thing, a storm. We can look at it. We see it. But what is it really? What is a hurricane?
Water and wind.
Water, wind, temperature, movement of something that impacts something else, ever-changing molecules, forces, interactivity. And so even though we're calling it a hurricane and we're looking at it on the map as if it's a picture and we give it a name, it's actually just a huge, unfolding, ever-changing process. And what this teaching is saying is our ever-changing process of how we're perceiving the world and remembering things, the meaning that we're making, the actions that we're taking because of our interpretation, all of that is no different than a hurricane. It's just this ever-changing process that is constantly flowing and flowing and flowing, and that we try to grab onto, and that trying to grab is a big part of why we suffer. Musong, the revolution of the Buddha was to investigate the matter of self and to not find any abiding existence. Not finding something unchanging. That's empty. That's what we mean by empty. Yes, there's a sense of self, he says, as a routine existential process embedded in the brain structures and linguistic usage, but not the self, like an essence or a soul or something solid and unchanging. And yet, it's not a rejection of the world of the senses. See, sometimes, we're starting to tiptoe into the form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And right, we're going to kind of look at that in a minute. But one could hear that, and as some of the early Buddhists, some of the more kind of fundamental interpretations of these teachings, oh, therefore, because all of that stuff is causing suffering, I have to try to push it away. I have to try to pretend it doesn't exist. I have to be some kind of ethereal, ghost somewhere that, you know. But and Dongchan, when he was a little boy and he was in the marketplace and he heard the Heart Sutra, where they go on to say, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. As we get further down, it just starts negating all of this stuff. He said, but I have eyes. I have a nose. I have a mouth. So this is, here's our koan. These things that we think are form are actually empty. But they're not nothing. Because yes, of course we do. We have eyes. We have ears. We have a nose. We have memory. We have perception. We have formation. We have consciousness. But ultimately, it is empty of unchanging nature. But it's not a rejection of the world of the senses. The Mahayana movement was away from what Musong calls the more puritanical, pure-impure framework. We talk about this sometimes, about the sense world. I know you and I always kind of go look at each other when we hear teachings about impurity of the sensual world, and Charlie and I always kind of wink at each other and go, maybe not, you know, because they are part of our ever-changing nature, that we don't exist separate from our senses. So if you're starting to feel a little bothered by this, that's great. because this is an understanding of unity that we get to through the gates of paradox. Mm-hmm. So, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, while practicing the deep practice of Prajnaparamita, perceived that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from suffering. What does that mean? Not clinging to this process. Not trying to fixate it into this unchanging reality of this means that. You'll never change. I'll never change. This is the suffering of clinging and fixating these skandhas. That early memory, that negative memory maybe from school or from childhood, that we listen to as if it was still the truth. That's the suffering of clinging to these skandhas. Shohaku says, we save ourselves from suffering when we open, release the grip, realize that it's ever-changing. So here we are at the point now, okay, so, you know, I was studying this stuff and I was starting to feel like, okay, I'm kind of starting to have a little bit of a glimmer of understanding of what this might mean. And then I was smacked by the deeper koan of how does this help me in this circumstance with my family? Should I lecture my sister-in-law about the emptiness of the skandhas?
Sure.
Wouldn't that be helpful? You know? I mean, I could see some of the suffering that I could see was coming from her fear and her replaying her fear over and over, one could say clinging to her fear, and I could see how it was impacting her daughter. I mean, I could see and feel that, and I was suffering with that. But what is the deep, important practice of the Bodhisattva? Is it to lecture people? Is it to try to follow some set of rules and be politically correct or religiously correct about whatever? No. You know, the most important thing is that others experience awakening and ease in our presence. The word prashamana in Sanskrit for heals all suffering. Heals is one of the translations, but also calming, to calm. And really, I mean, all of this is just about being present and intimate and awake together. So I really got this feeling of, it's not that studying this isn't helpful, but at that moment of sitting there with her, I realized this is for me in order to be able to be present for her. So what is Prajnaparamita right now? It's listening to her. It's not judging her. It's not lecturing her. It's receiving her. It's bearing witness. And in fact, I did try to say one little clever thing, and bless her soul, she said, "Don't lecture me." What a beautiful teaching. What a deep and beautiful teaching. How unhelpful that would be, you know?
What were you trying to say?
Oh, God. It was something about how we don't really know what's going to happen and we don't really know how this is going to be for her. And it was just like, just so not helpful. So not helpful. So, I had this gut feeling when I was sitting there of upaya is actually Trump's prajna. So I had this my own direct experience. So upaya paramita is another one of the paramitas, and it means skillful means. And it's one of the teachings where, you know, people would say to the Buddha, how come you taught it this way to this person and a different way to a different person? Or, hey, this teaching, that's not what you said the other night. How come now you're saying it this way? And he would always be saying, well, I'm just meeting what's in front of me, and I'm responding skillfully. Mm-hmm. You know, what's going to be the most liberating thing that I can do right now for this particular circumstance? And that's called upaya paramita, another one of the paramitas. So I had, it's not really true, because prajna, of course, is the mother paramita. Prajna paramita is the mother of the Buddhas, so I don't really mean it, but I had this feeling of actually upaya is trumps it, because, you know, even, you know, if I can create the experience of prajna in the room as defined by, what's that little list of things that I read when I first sat down? It's gone. I put it somewhere. Unknown. It doesn't matter. Oh, here it is. Okay. If I define prajna as seeing directly into the true nature of things and the direct apprehension of intimacy and interdependence, and if Shohaku says it's not about insight, it's a practice of living and interacting and being with others, then I would say that, you know, the prajna paramita of that moment was the skillful means of stopping the lecture and listening and being present. But then I was delighted when I read, I love Musang. I really, really recommend reading his stuff. He's got this book on the Heart Sutra, and also many people here are studying his Trust in Mind, the Thursday night group. Fabulous stuff. So I was really happy to read in Trust in Mind, this is a bit of an aside, but I just have to read it, where he says, all phenomena are empty, and each phenomena is in a state of suchness. They each have the same nature and are completely equal, and one cannot be privileged over the other. Therefore, the only thing that's relevant are skillful responses, upaya, in each situation, rather than a value system based on a conceptual framework. And that... that's what all the no-no-no-no's mean. Because when you get further in the Heart Sutra, actually the whole central part of it is a negation of all of these early teachings. It negates the skandhas. It negates the Four Noble Truths. It negates the 12-fold chain. All of these different formulations, helpful formulations, that the early Buddhists came up with after probably hundreds of thousands of hours of sitting and studying the mind. The Heart Sutra says no, 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 not concept. Beyond concept, you know, direct experience. So we could go there, but I actually would like to talk first about form does not differ from emptiness, and emptiness does not differ from form, and then I would like to open it up. Because, like I told you, I don't expect we'll get very far. This is a big topic, and I saw on the class schedule for next year, which I get to see because I'm on practice committee, it looks like there's going to be a class on the Heart Sutra. So that's great, because then these things could actually be studied slower. But this form is emptiness, emptiness is form. I feel like tonight it's very important for me to say a few words about that. I kind of started with it. Let me read Musang. So, form does not differ from emptiness. So that means And he uses particle physics as an example. So all appearances are made up of different components and are therefore not real in themselves. So like in physics, in Newtonian physics, they thought that matter was solid and was made up of these indestructible building blocks of matter. But when they started to study quantum physics and they started to look inside these solid blocks of matter, there was just space. And they actually realized that it's energy. So that is the emptiness of form. That's what form is empty means. Yeah, I do have a hand, but if we looked into my hand with an electron microscope, and if you look deeper and deeper down in, it's just energy and vibration and space. Okay? And a lot of time Buddhism kind of just, you know, stops there. But there's the other side, which is what makes this such a radical teaching, which is emptiness doesn't differ from form. So this universal energy that we're talking about here, it doesn't exist apart from form or phenomena. It's not a separate thing. There's not this thing called emptiness that's vibrating in this mystical universe that's separate from our very bodies, minds, and suffering. It cannot be sought as a thing in itself, apart from the totality of all forms. Forms are informed at their core by emptiness, but this conventional appearance doesn't... Although all forms are informed at their core by emptiness, this doesn't negate the conventional appearance of form. Right. Because, in truth, we're just energy and process, that doesn't negate that we are form. That's the emptiness of... That's emptiness does not differ from form. Shohaku says, for the form does not differ from emptiness. We have eyes, we have ears, we have nose, we have mouth, but they don't exist separately. They exist in relationship as a process of the body. So when we eat, we don't just eat with one thing. It's this whole integrated system that's operating together. So it's empty of separate. The mouth is not separate from the eye, it's not separate from the stomach. And yet they do have their separate functions, right? So I'll just read one thing he said, and then I'll give a personal example, and then I'll see where you might want to go with this. So Shohaku's example of emptiness does not differ from form, I thought was very sweet. The fact that we live in illusion and delusion is our reality. There's no other world that we live in. We are empty. But when we encounter others, we make a sound. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling. And that's prajna. Together with all beings, we express prajna. So I challenged myself to try to think of a personal example for form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And here's what I came up with. I thought of a relationship problems. Does anybody here have relationship problems? So, form. It is true that we have... Okay, so let's say here's the two people in the relationship. Yes, it's true. We have our respective body minds. We have our experiences. We have our perceptions. We have our memories, you know. And yet, at the same time, it's also true that we're really just these vibrating molecules, ever-changing, just, right? So both, we are actually a process. Our relationship is a dynamic process. There's no inherent truth to either of our stories. Don't we love to insist that our story is the right story? Why don't you see it the way I see it? You know, how can you think that way? Well, how can you think the way you think? Why don't you see it my way, right? Mm-hmm. There's no inherent truth to either of our stories, but it's not nothing, because we do impact one another. So, you know, it's like this thing that that you know, like I know in my relationship with Gene, I mean, on the one hand, I have to just realize that it's completely okay for him to just be the way he is, absolutely and completely. There is nothing that ever needs to change. And I also can make requests and say, would you please change that? Because we're human and we're in a relationship, right? But the liberation, I think, with this form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is that we can maybe be a little bit more fluid. You know, sometimes if you're feeling really stuck and identified with a fixed view, it can be very, very helpful to maybe shift to the emptiness side and to remind ourselves, you know, whatever it is that you can say, this too will change. It's possible that something different will happen. We'll wake up tomorrow and the energy will have shifted. Or there is no ultimate truth to either of our stories. Let's just take a walk and stop processing and just go look at the ocean. You know? Let's just go out and look at the stars. So what if I think I'm right and you think you're right? It's like, stop it, you know? But on the other hand, if you're just always, you know, oh, honey, whatever, yeah, it's all cool, it's all good, it's all groovy, you're over in emptiness, you know, maybe sometimes you need to shift a little more to form. Now, let's get really clear here. This actually matters to me. This really does. This matters to me. And I really ask you, please, to make the effort to look at that. You know, that's form. Not right and wrong, just two different aspects of the same dance. So what did I write here? I said, our ultimate liberation is the dance of working with and through our delusion. We had an experience. Oh boy, am I going to post this? I've already said so much. But that, I guess I will. You know, we had this, it wasn't a disagreement the other day. It was just a expressing our different needs conversation and feeling kind of like, oh God, you know, this is probably never going to change. And then we got to a point where, you know, after whatever had been said, we were just holding each other and just crying. Just that. Nothing got solved. Nothing got fixed. Nobody changed. We were just, you know, in the intimacy of just the human condition. That was the night I almost didn't come to be Doshi. Because I thought, oh, I'm too upset to come and be Doshi. But after we had that experience where we just cried. And just felt each other's hearts just beating together. And I and then after that, I, rather than, you know, going to my story, I just sat with the feeling of intimacy and I just allowed words to come up. And the words that came up, I said something like, well, are you giving up about this particular issue? Are you giving up? And he said, no, I'm not. And then I felt, okay, I can drive across town and go be Doshi. And by the time I got here, I was like, yeah, life is good. And to me, that's form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's what that teaching means, you know, for me at a very personal level. So I know I said I was going to allow time for discussion, and here it is, it's 6 minutes until we're supposed to close, so I'm going to see if there's anything anybody else wants to say. Obviously, you know, this is a really rich, that's what I think why we chant it every day, because there's so much there. So, any comments or questions? Yes?
Kathy, I so appreciated how you unpacked the word emptiness, since that's so crucial. And, you know, we can go around dazed by just that word. It's a solid thing that something's empty, you know. And then, so I'm changing, impermanent, flowing, process. And, you know, so that gives that word we don't want to say it, it's some kind of concreteness anyway, a specificity that by itself it feels formidable.
Yeah.
I mean, it has often to me. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I've also had that experience. And I think the analogies are helpful. I think that analogy of Newtonian and quantum physics, for me personally, is very helpful. Or the wave and the particle, you know, because we do recognize that. Like a wave is not a thing. And yet we see them and we talk about them, but they're just rolling, ever-changing water molecules. So it is both a form and an emptiness. Yeah.
I appreciate your talk very much in terms of unpacking and making, well, because there's a real mystical element beyond language, and yet you sort of have to say something.
Right. Exactly.
But what it really comes down to, and this is, I think, one of my favorite koans or koans. I don't remember the number of which book it's from, but one of the Chinese masters was asked by a senior student what was the most important thing he'd learned in his life. And his simple answer was an appropriate response.
Mm-hmm. What?
An appropriate response.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But then that's my koan. What is an appropriate response to each and every situation?
Yep.
Not what I want or my conditioning tells me, but what's best for all concerned.
Yeah.
And is that from here? And there's no, you can't quantify it anyway. You can just learn as you fail how to do it better next time.
Yeah.
And keep trying.
And to me, as I hear you say that, I hear what you're describing is Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva,
yes,
when practicing the deep practice of Prajna Paramita, perceived.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. That's why you need 1,000 arms, if not more.
Yeah.
You have to respond appropriately. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry if I might share just something that came to me in the poetic question. What is the neutral norm of form in the body's container of this vehicle horn, between the worn and the torn, between the porn and the corn? If it's all contained within the room called a dorm, what is the neutral norm that we reform?
Thank you. Yes.
Just to take the opportunity, because I appreciated so much that analogy of the dance, you know, and to really embrace that, you know, if you look at the relationship, of course, you know, it's not only two people trying to work out the same problem, but if you look at dancers, they have to do it, or else someone's going to fall on their ass. They're going to break their arm or something. You know? So their job is to, with beauty and with elegance and with, you know, to work this dance out together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love that analogy, that why is that in any way any different than relationship or the way we dance through our whole lives? You know?
Yeah.
But remember, you know, how cooperative that dance must be.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, practice and practice and work done.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the word dance. It really works for me when I think about, well, then what is this thing that we're doing, you know? And it's a dance, and we dance and we move in relationship to each other. Yeah.
To build on that concept and what Richard said, what I was thinking about when you said, and we practice and we learn, you know, but what we learn isn't the way to do it. Maybe what we learn, you know, partly what we learn is the trust to move and the ability to attend, so that as we are dancing, it's not like we know the next step.
Yes.
But our ability to attend and respond, yeah, maybe if we're lucky, through a lifetime, mm-hmm, a little bit,
yeah,
more.
Yeah. I agree. And, you know, in the relationship analogy, you know, I think so often, or just not even just in a interpersonal, but say in a group situation, say, like, oh, what am I supposed to do? Tell me what to do. Or we want to have some solidity to it rather than, I don't know, let's let's enter the truth of the moment together and see what arises. And let's wait, and let's let the words, if there are words, arise out of actually not knowing and sensing, and then doing our best to do something helpful. Yeah. Okay, it's time to stop. And even though it's dark now, it's still not cold. It's a warm evening. So in a moment, we'll chant the final chant. And then there will be a few announcements. And then when I go outside, I'll turn on the light. And then those who wish to stay for tea and cookies, and if you want to keep talking about any of this, we'll be hanging out on the patio. So... to be continued. And of course, I don't know why I brought all the notes, even though I knew I was going to barely touch it. But why not? You never know.
Sneak preview.
Sneak preview of something. Who knows what? Okay. So, thank you very much. Beings are numberless.